Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, author J.D. Solomon will be joining us. Now, J.D. has just published a historical fiction novel titled Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I am happy to welcome author Dennis Powers to the show. He is here to talk about his just-released book, Taking the Sea, Perilous Waters, Sunken Ships, and the True Story of the Legendary Wrecker Captain. So Dennis has authored 10 books, including his last four about his longtime interest, the sea. His first release in 2005 was The Raging Sea, which chronicled the crushing 1964 tsunami that ravaged the U.S. West Coast. In 2006, he released Treasure Ship, and that was about the final discovery of a long-lost ghost ship that sank off the Northern California coast with millions of dollars of gold bullion. 2007, he came out with Sentinel of the Seas, which tells the story of the most remote, dangerous, and expensive lighthouse ever built in U.S. history. And now he is coming out with Taking the Sea, which is about the adventurous tales of wreckers or ship salvagers, from the tall clipper ships to the huge liners of today. Dennis Powers was a business law attorney before teaching as a full professor and later becoming professor emeritus at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, Oregon. He is a graduate of the University of Colorado, the University of Denver Law School, and Harvard Business School. Dennis resides in Ashland, Oregon, with his wife, Judy, their three cats, and a library of books. And you can find out more information about Dennis and his books through his website, DennisPowersBooks.com. So with that said, welcome to the program, Dennis.
It's great to be here, and again with Reader Views.
Yes, you know, I've been following these books that you just keep putting out year after year after year. You must be a very busy guy.
Well, you know, it's been very enjoyable for me because I've been able to get into and find a niche with same resources. And I just really find the people that I talk to be really enjoyable, the stories adventurous, and the tales of the sea just to be as thrilling as it was now as it was when I first started going into it.
So is it your research then that's kind of informing you on your next book? It's leading to the other?
Well, you know, that's a great question. It's very serendipitous. As a matter of fact, from The Raging Sea about that crushing 1964 tsunami, I headed to Treasure Ship, which was about a vessel called the Brother Jonathan that had been lost for 125 years, but it was in the same area, the same general region of the West Coast. And then while I was working on that one, Juanita, next thing I knew was that they built this grand, big, huge, dangerous, most remote and expensive lighthouse ever built in response to the Brother Jonathan's demise.
Mm.
And then, while I was doing the research for Sentinel of the Seas, which is about the lighthouse, I then came across a Captain Whitlaw, and I was wondering, who is this person? And he owned the various ships that were used in the construction over 10 years of this gigantic lighthouse off of the Northern California coast. And I kept saying to myself, what type of a person would risk these valuable ships in that type of a maelstrom of currents and off-the-story building-sized waves and the climate that shifted with winds that would go 125 miles an hour. What type of person would be that lend me to this Captain Whitlaw, who was in the 19th century and finally passed away, if you will, after 60 years of being in this business of wrecking or ship salvaging? in 1930. And so from there, I got into this wonderful place of wreckers and ship salvagers and these tales of adventure on the sea and of courage and really of nature, which is one of my themes of the way nature can fool all of us and the way all of us have to go ahead and surmount that.
You know, it had to have been such dangerous work back then, really, with like you say, with nature, with storms, hurricanes. It was very dangerous.
It was, and what was interesting there, Juanita, is that ships and vessels then were our trucks, buses, and trains that were over all the waterways, the oceans, the lakes, the bays, the rivers. I mean, this was before we had airports and large 747s. It was before we had huge container ships. And so shipping was the dominant way of moving goods and passengers then, and these ships would have anywhere from 5 to 7 separate incidences, if you will, of collisions or groundings, and it was dangerous not only for the captains and the sailors and ship salvagers, but of course for the passengers like you and I that would use that to go from A to B, from New York City to San Francisco around the Horn.
It was transportation.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Well, so how did the whole business of wrecking actually work? What was the life of a wrecker? How did that all go down?
Well, that was so interesting when I finally started getting into who is this magic person, Captain Whitlaw, because I'd never heard of him and most people haven't, but he was very well known back in the age and the era of our grandparents. Really what wreckers were captains and seamen for a cut of the goods that they saved, would rescue people, salvage goods, and save ships, hopefully in that order. These were an intrepid, reckless group of sailors that really basically ruled the ocean and made their living by rescuing ships in distress, raising sunken ones even in the face of monstrous waves and fierce conditions. But as a livelihood, Juanita, dated back to the rugged coastlines of Europe, back in the 16th and 17th centuries, which was a haven for wreckers and smugglers. And needy villagers would actually follow stricken ships in the hopes of improving their lives a little. When they immigrated to the United States, they brought along these same traditions. They even built the town of Key West in Florida. And what was interesting there was that when ships foundered, the word went of wreck ashore, and you'd have a flotilla of streaking schooners that would race to try to get to the ship first, because whichever captain got to that distressed vessel first was designated the master wrecker.
Okay.
And then they would receive a cut from the share of the goods that were saved.
Obviously, it was very competitive.
It was, and I would have loved to have been able to have been there to have seen the sight of when, the wreck ashore, yelled across, and these schooners and flotillas would sail as fast as they could. At times, upwards of 100 of these would be sailing to try to get there first.
Well, how would they know at that time that there was a ship that was in trouble?
Well, typically what happened was that you would even have sentry ships, and these would be fishermen who would be out at the sea, and if they saw one, they would quickly turn around and head back to, let's say, Key West in this time, or it could be San Francisco, California, it could even be to New York City, and tell their best friend who was a captain who was in that business that there was a ship that was 50 miles, let's say, up the coast heading towards Connecticut. And so, of course, then that captain would get his couple of ships over and try to see if they could save the ship. And the first one there, of course, would negotiate with that captain and would be able to reach an agreement, and that was the way they earned their livelihood.
And it was a monetary agreement.
Oh, it was. Yeah. I'm going to tell you.
Very lucrative business.
And there was a fair line, my friend, between what was fair or not, because the ship's master was, of course, at a very distinct disadvantage here. And in the beginning, abuses did happen. I mean, goods disappeared on the way to the dock. Even captains and wreckers conspired about a wreck. And so it was really a rough and tumble world where you'd even have fights between competing wreckers at that time. Except that over time, and when you got into, just before the Civil War, and then afterwards, into the 1880s, you started having laws that were starting to take place, and it became a competitive business for hire, and it's that in that way even to the year 2009.
Wow. So, well, how many wreckers then, or how many people would be employed by a master wrecker? Like, how many on a ship?
Well, interesting enough, as a business, you might have at that time a captain who was in the wrecking business might have upwards of 100 sailors doing different types of things with different types of skills, from being divers to carpenters, all the way to being able to operate the donkey engines, because before technology and electric-driven winches, you would have donkey engines that were driven by coal, it was by steam. On the other hand, though, you'd have interesting situations where ship captains who sailed and came upon another vessel in distress when needed would then go ahead and see if they could help out, because the laws of the sea allowed for a very handsome reward if you saved a ship in distress, and they could make more by saving that vessel that was now foundering in that heavy surf than they could by carrying through to their next destination and deliver their goods.
Mm-hmm. There must have been a lot of activity on the seas back then.
They were. There really was.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, in today's wrecking age, there is going to be a lot of different equipment that's used, but I'm sure back then the tools and equipment were quite primitive for the salvaging.
Well, that was what really interested me. I was looking at the difference, because over this time period that we're looking at, which was really after the Civil War, going into just before World War II, but it's more than history. It was the stories of the adventure of these wreckers. You'd have divers that used to communicate. They'd have a line attached to their sleeve of their diver's dress, and they would tug on it to give signals, because there was no wireless radios then. They used hacksaws to try to take away anchors that were holding them down, or to cut away planks. They used hammers with hooks and wooden caps. They only could go down as far as 100 feet. But then over time, when ships started changing, going from schooners to steel-hulled vessels, past the time, if you will, of the Titanic, they had acetylene torches, electric-powered generators, electric winches, concrete that dried in water, and caulks. But again, as you saw this technology changing, you saw that the dangerous times were always there when salvagers would try to go ahead and save these ships. And of course, it made a difference whether it was a schooner or a large steel-hulled cruise liner grounded in the sands, or hit a reef and sunk, hopefully, in shallow water.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was technology then that really changed the entire wrecking business?
In one sense, it did, because it made it safer for passengers, captains, and even ship salvagers. You know, when you'd have double hulls, steel hulls, you'd even have GPS, which allowed instant communication with wireless radio and radar.
Mm-hmm.
But the conditions are still the same. What amazed me was looking at a recent salvage off of Alaska, where a huge container ship, due to shifting conditions, weather conditions, and also a mistake made in its ballast, just capsized.
Mm.
And what amazed me was, and I had an unfortunate death of one of the salvagers who was trying to work on to save that ship. But what amazed me was the concept was still the same in terms of shifting water balance, of sealing the ship from the inside, pumping that water out, and then using, in this case, steel cables instead of rope hawsers to go ahead and pull the ship over. But what interested me was the fact that the concepts were still the same, the danger was still there, and yet, let's say when our grandparents were using ships to go from A to B, what amazed me was the fact that the danger was even greater in those days, And the concepts are still the same today, even with our modern technology.
Mm-hmm. You would think that these ships would be more protected, and one wouldn't sink like that or tip. That's so interesting. Well, how many, in this day and age, how many ships are actually going down? We don't hear about this very often in the news.
Well, there is less. That
yeah.
is very true. There is less because the fact that you do have radar, so you have much less collisions. And because of not only the technology, if there is a collision, it's much more likely that that ship is going to be going ahead and be able to make it to port for repairs. But in today's day, we have the Somalia pirates that are operating
yes.
offshore that are having a field day, you know, with a disorganized world, if you will, in terms of the way commerce is going through that particular strait. You also have hurricanes and huge perfect waves that storm across and crash down on ships. So you still have some danger, although it certainly is safer, and thank goodness it is. I was on giving presentations on a large cruise ship about a year ago, and what amazed me was the way it was a totally contained city with all the different amenities from a barber shop, you know,
mm-hmm.
to being able to shop for shoes.
Yeah, the whole cruise ship concept is really interesting. You know, I'm so glad you mentioned the idea of the pirates, the Somalia pirates. Were these wreckers kind of our idea of pirates? Is that where that came from?
Well, you know, that's another really good question because in the beginning, it was a situation where there was a fine line between were they really pirates that were holding up a ship in distress, you know, whether or not they were actually angels that came upon.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that they would try to save passengers, but also they certainly negotiated a handsome fee. But once this industry, if you will, developed where large insurance companies would let contracts to where the wreckers would have to bid on them. It was regulated by laws. It became really a regulated industry for hire. But the same conditions, the same danger, the same problems that are gone into the book Taking the Sea were still there.
So at this point, then, it's a private business? It's not federally or government regulated?
Still private all the way through. And now, today, you have, you know, let's say then you had, like, Whitlaw, the Whitlaw Wrecking Company. You had on the East Coast, some of your listeners might recall the word Merritt and Chapman and Taylor, because Merritt, Chapman, Taylor was a very large entity until it was liquidated in the 1970s. But then these wreckers were then changed. They actually went out of business, but you had large global companies, and these large salvage mm-hmm. subsidiaries now have names like Titan and Don John and Switzer and Smith International, and they work globally.
Mm-hmm.
But the same functions are there.
It's the same, yeah.
It's just what's so amazing. You have less, thank goodness, less collisions. You have less problems. But on the other hand, we remember the Exxon Valdez and the spills that happen from oil tankers. And that is also part of the same salvaging business that we have today, because commerce, about a third of it still comes by ships, you know, whether it's Toyotas coming across the West Coast or French wines coming across the east, or huge ore carriers going across the Great Lakes. All the conditions that we had then are still now, and we have all this mammoth moving of goods
mm-hmm.
and passengers more luxurious now, you know, across country borders.
You know, with the amount of goods that are transported in this day and age with, you know, free trade and the global market that we do have, it would be interesting to consider how many big ships like that are actually on the ocean, say, right now.
It's in the thousands.
Yeah.
And if you add in navies, you're going to be into the 10,000s.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is with GPS, it's almost like if you had a U.S. federal controller who was looking at all of these airplanes that were landing. Well, it's the same thing with all these ships at sea.
So tell us then a little more about Thomas Whitlaw. He is the master wrecker that you're kind of focusing on in your book. So tell us who he was, where he came from, and he really built up his name, his reputation into a huge fortune.
He did, and the reason why I chose Whitlaw was that not only was the most well-known, it was because I could use him as a way of showing this industry that was taking place. I could use him also with all of the dangerous escapades that he has and what I learned from going in the research. But, you know, he arrived in San Francisco at age 16 with 25 cents to his name.
I know. I heard that. That's incredible. We could learn something from him, I think.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. I'm talking today with Dennis Powers. He is the author of Taking Sea, and you can find out more about Dennis and all of his books at DennisPowersBooks.com.
And what was really amazing, Juanita, was that within 25 years, he was extensively engaged in mining, real estate ventures, had a stock ranch of about 50,000 acres. He was an avid reader of the Greek classics, a self-taught philosopher, and he was really a genius. He ranged far. He was based in San Francisco, but he did work not only in the East Coast, but ranged up to the Bering Sea, going to the north and down to Mexico on the south. And at the same time, he had his counterparts in the East Coast that were also rising into prominence, and their stories were also an integral part of the book. What was interesting, though, was that although he was very successful because he had this innate ability to look at a ship that had sunk, if you will, and to figure out ways of creating an artificial buoyancy so they could save the ship at much less cost than it would cost, of course, to build a new one. But even though he had a lot of experiences in areas, you know, where he was working on one ship and it just started disintegrating from his feet, and he had to jump off to save his life. Another time, another large coal freighter was split in half, and he had to leap to the other side. The rigging and mast crashed down about him, but he was lucky. A railing that was still up had saved that from crashing around him. So he had all these almost spiritual experiences, including one where he was, an oil tanker had been impaled on a rock, and the crew placed inside a surgical explosive device that shattered the rock, used cement and steel patches to steal the ship. But when pulling the tanker from the reef, it suddenly sprang from the hawser's tautness straight at his wrecked ship, so they had to quickly try to get out of the way of this out-of-control tanker. Then, indeed, he had to turn around, which is amazing, and in that wrecked ship, steam as fast as they could after it and rope it with a thick rope, just like you would rope a steer.
Oh, what a sight that must have been.
You know, and these were the stories that really interested me. But then when he got to the Depression, he was overextended. He went bankrupt, and the reason for it was that he always would take these risky adventures on a pay-as-you-go basis. In other words, he would put the front money up. If he was successful, he'd get a good cut of the profits or of the negotiated value. But on the other hand, if he wasn't successful, he just assumed those losses. He was a person that lived his life. But what he did was, the day when they were selling off the some of the ships, if you will, and what he had in his business, the used parts that he had gone ahead. He had a used part lot for ships when they needed to be repaired. He turned around and he took up a stake and he pounded it into the ground on an adjacent lot and he said, "Captain Whitlaw, salvager in business." And he was 84 at the time.
Oh, my gosh. He loved this work. He had a gift for it and obviously a great passion.
He did. And, again, it was a very interesting way for me to open up this whole area of wreckers.
Yeah.
And ship salvagers and the tales of the sea from passengers all the way to the captains that will be caught in a horrendous type of hurricane.
Now, you're also bringing East Coast wreckers into this book. Tell us about some of them.
Very much so. There were different incidences that happened. And, of course, I didn't go into all of the type of experiences and incidents that happened to ships. I would take the most important ones or the ones that are most memorable. And yes, you did have Captain Merrick, for example, had an entity that operated in the 30s, 40s, and 50s of the 20th century that went into saving ships, whether or not they overturned suddenly at their pier or hit some rocky shoals or grounded on a shore. And there were instances, for example, of where you'd have, if you could believe this, passenger ships, Juanita, that were racing one another through a dark, deep, dense fog. Mm. And one of these ships that was 600 feet long grounded on the New Jersey shore. And we go into how they went ahead and finally were able to save that ship, which included a monstrous storm that had to come in because you needed more water to come in so that the boat could ship, the tugs that came in. And, of course, the passengers on this one had no idea that their captain was racing their ocean liner.
How did you find that out?
Well, in the official transcripts, the transcripts never went into that one little fact, but when you went ahead in terms of some of the records, you found out that, yes, in fact, they were.
They were racing. Isn't that something? You must have really come across some interesting information in the whole research process.
Well, that was what was fun because, again, to me, it's the tales and the stories. There was one of a ghost ship, which was a vessel that had overturned at its pier, and unfortunately some sailors died inside there. Whitlaw was going ahead and figured out a very ingenious way of raising that ship because it had heeled over by its dock and its masts were basically dug into the floor of the ocean. And there were various ghost tales, including once they had raised it, where the watchman would see and hear strange noises and lights. And one of the experiences was so frightening when a spirit seemed to come shooting out of one of the hatches that he never came back to that dock again, although the stories were told from bar to bar when he could get a drink.
That's great. That's fantastic. Now, you are also not only the East Coast, but from what I understand, you talk a little bit about the Great Lakes.
And that was fascinating because what amazed me is the Great Lakes is the largest group of freshwater lakes on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have tremendous rough waves that would build up, especially with your ore carriers. We all remember the Fitzsimmons that ran into such a tragedy at that point. And so there are stories in terms of what the salvagers ran into in terms of the Great Lakes. One of the interesting ones was a very huge bulk ore carrier that was as long as 2 football fields.
Wow.
And when it crashed on a reef on Lake Superior, different folks tried to save it. They couldn't. But actually what they finally were able to do was to save the stern, 300 feet long. And so there was different experiences in terms of the stern. And then finally they attached a 300-foot new bow to have a now new 600-foot long ship that spent another 50 years in service. But again, it was the courage that was shown to me. Men and women who were trying to beat Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm. It really is an interesting aspect of our history when you look at these stories and the courage of the people, and it's fascinating.
I found that, and again, it's going back to our grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
As the type of life that they had. I was also using the book to bring in kind of vignettes to show how history and lives were changing other than just the maritime world. I found it fascinating to be able to take this glimpse into this world where, you know, especially when times are tight today,
mm-hmm.
we can look back, we see that people survived. They did just fine.
Mm-hmm.
They had less, and maybe that's why they could do more.
Great point. Really good point. So, Dennis, where did this whole passion for the sea begin for you? Has this been since you were young, or was this later in life?
You know, that's an excellent question. I've always had it. I grew up on the East Coast. I went to school in the Midwest, if you will, and then also on the West Coast. I would body surf. I would sail.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm on a lake, I would sail in regattas on lakes. There's something about the magnificence of the ocean and the waters, because, you know, it's almost like life itself.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're driving a car and all of a sudden we hear a honk and someone shoots in front of us, and that's just the way life is. Life is at times a pinball machine, a giant pinball machine. Well, that's what the sea is too, because all of a sudden winds can whip up. I've been caught off of ports in Mexico when a wind whipped up and I was in a sailboat trying to bring it back to port, and that particular boat lost its rudder, and I had to do some gerrymandering, and we almost foundered and were swapped over, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about the vagaries, if you will, of life that I see in the sea.
Mm-hmm. So you actually sail as well. I didn't know that.
Well, not as much I now when I'm writing about it, but I sure was able to have the enjoyment when the times were there.
I wonder if researching and finding out about all these, you know, these ships that are sinking at sea and the storms and all of this, if it instills any fear in you.
Well, that's a good question. It doesn't. And, you know, interesting enough about taking the sea was that the one area that I really want to try to get into, because I really enjoy bringing in the character of the people, because we're talking about the people that are involved here, and I was finding it difficult to really find out more about these records and specifically Whitlaw, and then I came across a long-lost tape that was really, in fact, a full day, although it was really primarily done in an afternoon of taping by his grandson that went into all the little stories, such as the odd salvaging that he did. I mean, when he was during Prohibition, trying to go ahead and get these bottles of whiskey because of the fact that it would be a magnificent score.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had little problems getting the permission from the U.S. government. So it was getting these vignettes, also one of when one had a locomotive that had gone off the trestle. Well, just what do you do when you have a locomotive that's sitting there in 40 feet of water?
Yeah.
And the way that the people involved are trying to figure out ways of getting that locomotive up. But again, it's the people.
Yeah.
It's what they're doing, and it's their characters, and do they have fear? Whitlaw never had fear. He, on the other hand, was penurious. He really watched his pennies, but of course that's the way that he was able to come in to take a quarter up to millions, lose it, not really care.
Mm.
So it's to me, my friend, it's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's very fascinating.
As the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing next?
Oh, you have the great question.
Yes.
I have just gotten into writing a manuscript about a sea captain that was a folk hero off of Alaska, Hawaii, and sailed in the Atlantic, and so I'm looking at the oceans from now the vantage point of sea captains. I mean, just what was it like to sail? I mean, really, what was really like to sail on the seven seas, in the 19th century? And then, okay, we have the modern cruise liners. Yeah, where are they like, and what was it different? And so I'm using that vehicle now to open up that area.
You know, I imagine back, you know, years and years ago, the sea captain, I mean, that he made the ultimate decisions on everything. I wonder if that's changed in modern day with technology, with the radar we have, you know, that there's more people that may be making decisions.
Well, you know, that's another great question. And the reason is that the captains of today still have, when they're on the ocean, that command, that authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the rare opportunity of spending time with the captain of a huge cruise ship that was 1,000 feet long. I gave him a copy of one of my books. I was also giving presentations, on Central of the Seas.
That was your research.
Yeah, Treasure Ship, and these different ones. And I just had the steward give a copy of a book to him. And he was very nice to invite my wife and I up to the bridge, and we spent time with him. And I really got to see the education, the experience that these captains have, because they are in command of a virtual city, as I had mentioned, where you could have upwards of 2,500 passengers and 1,000 crew members. And every little problem that comes up that if his managers, if you will, can't handle it, he has to. But what was so magnificent, though, in a grand gesture, was when my wife and I went down to dinner, and we were with a table with friends, he had ordered to be sent over to our table a fine bottle of wine.
Hey.
It was a real classy gesture.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
So they run, they are the ones. They are the CEO and the chief financial officer of these ships when they're on the sea.
And they still are. How interesting. So when do you think you'll have that book put together?
Well, that one should be coming out in another year, and the publisher is very happy with it, and it's called Tales of the Seven Seas.
Mm.
So we still have seas that are in there. For some reason, we have Central of the Seas, we have Taking the Sea.
It's still in you.
It's still there. But I think part of the reason, too, is that I find it fascinating, I find it enthusiastic, I enjoy it, and also I really am... I'm very much enjoying the way readers come back to me. I have a website that's DennisPowersBooks.com, and I have readers that stay with me, that come up to me, and they ask me questions through the website or if I'm at a book sign. And so I really enjoy that personal aspect of it.
Yeah. You, Dennis, you get such good reviews for your books. I mean, the comments are really spectacular. So
you're onto
something for sure.
Well, I appreciate that, and I've always been very appreciative of that, and I really try to do my best. Each book I want to try to make better than the last one, and sometimes, you know, you're saying, boy, I don't know about the bar on this one, because I love this one, but I love the last one.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been to your website several times, and I have to say I love it. I think it's you have a new site, and you've got pictures up there of the sea, and I mean, I could just have that on as my desktop. I love it.
Well, that's really kind of you. And the pictures that are from the photo insert, and a couple of some that aren't, I put on the website, and we have it totally oriented now to taking the sea. Although the other books, Raging Sea, Treasure Ship, and Central of the Seas, are there's also information there with similar pictures and excerpts, mm-hmm. and some of the reviews and advanced comments.
Now, are you doing any book signings in your area?
Yeah, I am. We're lining them up. I'll be which is interesting, at the San Francisco Maritime Museum, which is in the San Francisco area, which I'm really looking forward to.
Mm.
And I think that's going to be April 5th. And then I have a book signing in my area in Southern Oregon, Northern California, and then also I'll be heading up to the Columbia River Maritime Museum. And, you know, just for your listeners, the Columbia River Maritime Museum, which I find as fascinating as the San Francisco Maritime Museum, as the ones in New York, as the ones that I've gone through in Chicago, and these are all grand places, but that's an acre in size, although probably no one's ever heard of it.
Wow.
It's right on the Columbia River, which is a magnificent river that comes in that side, very much like the Hudson is on the East Coast. That is an unbelievable river, the way it courses still through to different places and different towns and cities.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find most of your readers are coastal or have lived on the coast or lived by the sea?
That is what's interesting to me. I'm finding there's a real dispersal, if you will, whether it's the Midwest Iowa, from Iowa to Florida, of course, Florida being the coast. I'm finding that people who have an interest in the sea have that interest, even if they're not on the coast. Sometimes it's because they grew up on the coast, and other times it's just because they're fascinating with it, or perhaps they fish, sail, or swim on all the many inland lakes, or they're acquainted with the Great Lakes, or any of the magnificent lakes in all the other states of this country that are inland. And so I found that there's a very wide diversity, if you will.
You know, I think that most people have some kind of fascination with the sea or with water, with lakes, like you say, or rivers, you know, whatever is accessible to them in their area. But there is just such a fascination, and you've really captured the sea in your book. So,
well, that's very kind of you. I really appreciate that. And the there's almost at times, even in this modern world, when we talk about stock markets and we talk about economies and the internet, there's almost a primitive feeling about the ocean that's even with us today, where it reduces everything to its basics. And you know, I would find it very calming that I would sit by an ocean beach just by myself and watch the waves come in and look at the people, or if I was fishing on a lake or sailing, or if I was at a dock. In Colorado, there were reservoirs I'd go to. It's kind of a way of calming oneself, of becoming one with where you want to be.
That's beautiful. Dennis, it's been great talking with you today. The time is just flying by. We're going to have to close here, but I just appreciate you coming on to the show so very much.
I really enjoy being with you in Reader Views. I find both you, Tyler, Irene, to be not only very professional, but really fun to work with. I've been with you for, including Irene and Tyler, for the last several books. It is really a pleasure on my part.
Oh, and ours too. You are definitely one of our favorites. So we really appreciate you and all the best. I know that Taking the Sea is probably going to be your best-selling of all of your books. I mean, it really is a fantastic read. So all the best to you, and I know we'll be talking again.
Well, thank you, and my best, of course, to all of you, and take care.
Okay. All right, listeners, that's been Dennis Powers. His latest book, Taking the Sea, Perilous Waters, Sunken Ships, and the True Story of the Legendary Wrecker Captain, is out now. And you can find out more about Dennis and all of his books at DennisPowersBooks.com. So do check it out. I hope you've enjoyed our interview today. Thanks so much for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live again. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.